hi there. Welcome back. Thanks for tuning in once again. This is Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik from Sweden. And if you're new to the program, what you might want to know is that this is an independent radio program. We cover a lot of different topics related to cover-ups, secret agendas, conspiracies, hidden history, and our forgotten past. We go far and wide in our search for answers, and we inquire into most topics that we consider to be important to know more about. William Mullen, or Bill Mullen, is our guest today, and our topic is the origin of the Egyptian hieroglyphics as being rooted in plasma cosmology and what's known as the ancient sky. Dr. Mullen received his Bachelor's of Arts in Classics from Harvard College in 1968 and his PhD from the University of Texas in 1972. He was a professor or a postdoctoral fellow at Berkeley, Princeton, Boston University, and Harvard's Center for Hellenic Studies and St. John's College. Dr. Mullen settled in the classic department at Bard College in New York in 1985. Hey, Bill, thank you for coming on Red Ice Radio. Good to talk to you. Hope you're doing well today.
Certainly am, and it's been nice to get to know you in our little prelude here of Henrik. So I'm ready to answer questions and go off on riffs or tangents and come back to the center or whatever you like.
Well, sounds good. This is very interesting. I wanted to get you on, obviously, because you're one of the speakers on the upcoming Electric Universe conference here in 2014. And the subject that you're going to talk more about sounds really, really interesting. Hieroglyphics and the ancient sky, the connection to plasma cosmology and this basic idea that the symbols that were seen by ancient man is something that led later to languages and symbols and everything else. So, and this might be a somewhat complicated subject for some. We have talked about this in the past. We've had various guests with us to talk about not only plasma cosmology, but this idea of the Saturn configuration and everything else. But if you can, Bill, introduce these topics a little bit to us. And if you want to, you can share some of your background as well in terms of laying the groundwork of how you kind of stumbled onto this subject, Bill.
All right. Well, it all began the fall after I graduated from college. I was introduced to Emmanuel Velikovsky's Worlds in Collision, and then by chance, 2 months later, he came near to the campus I was doing my PhD, and I met the man, was very impressed, offered to be his personal assistant that summer, and I had a special attraction for him, namely that I had been teaching myself Egyptian hieroglyphics, which he did not know. So it worked out beautifully, and I found myself many an afternoon whispering with Velikovsky in the Princeton library over some hieroglyphic text. So my motivation to teach myself hieroglyphs, over and above my intrinsic motivation as a linguist to learn as many languages as I can, was to help Velikovsky in his work. So now, many years later, that was 1970, I've returned to a robust sense that Velikovsky was onto something, and that is mainly due to the work of Dave Talbot and Walt Thornhill and also Ed Cochran, all of whom, by embracing the plasma cosmology paradigm, have shown that, as Velikovsky argued, it is possible for the planets in the solar system to have changed positions, to have evolved within human memory. So working with Velikovsky on hieroglyphs has proved very useful now. And the reason I'm mentioning working with Egyptian hieroglyphs in my talk for the EU conference is that I'm using an idea that you can find in Thunderbolts of the Gods by Talbot and Thornhill. It is that archetypes, as they call them, are primary earliest examples of things seen in the sky, which are particularly subject to visual representation, but also in stories. And they are counterintuitive. They don't look like something you're familiar with. As opposed to symbols, which later develop once the original archetype is no longer experienced or well understood. Their distinction then is between counterintuitive archetypes from the events in the sky themselves and later symbols that evolve. Now, the simple task I'm setting myself for my talk is to go through the list of Egyptian hieroglyphs and find those few which just don't look like anything we see around us. Most of them do. It's a very concrete language with pictographs, and you can look at an eye and see an eye and so forth. But when you get to certain areas, you're looking at hieroglyphs which don't look like anything we see. And at that point, I'm asking, is this perhaps, in the sense of Talbot and Thornhill, an archetype, something which they wrote down from early vision of the ancient sky and kept, even though it doesn't look like anything we see today? So that's the point of my talk, very concrete, to go into just a few of those counterintuitive archetypes in Egyptian hieroglyphics and connect them to the myths and scenarios that Talbot and Thornhill and Cochrane are so involved in, as are many others.
Very interesting. Now, let's see if we can identify some of them, and maybe we can just talk a little bit more generally about the Egyptian hieroglyphs, you know, how many there are, and it seems then, as you explained this, that there are a few that are archetypal, perhaps a few of them that are that stand out from the rest of them, and these might be the kind of the proto glyphs, if you will. I don't know if I make that assumption correct, Bill.
Yes. Well, first of all, there are, if memory serves, a little over 500 hieroglyphic signs. They have been ordered by the famous Egyptologist Sir Alan Gardner in his massive Egyptian grammar, by a system which first takes hieroglyphs representing man, woman, anthropomorphic gods, parts of the human body, mammals, and so forth, down to strokes, signs, and figures, and unclassified, meaning they don't even know what they are. So that's the pool. And in an excellent recent book, An Egyptian Glyphery by Bill Petty, you can take any hieroglyph and look it up by Gardner's system and find all the words that have that hieroglyph in them. That means you can get a sense for the range of meaning the hieroglyph is capable of generating. Now, when you get to these counterintuitive hieroglyphs, it's often a much smaller range, and they don't really know what to say. Can I give you a couple of examples of hieroglyphs that are counterintuitive?
Yeah, certainly. I think that would be a good idea.
Okay. You go to the sun, and you can find an image of the sun with a cobra reaching out from it. So in other images, the god of the sun, a complicated topic in itself, but let's just say the sun for now, has to protect him against spirits of destructiveness, a swelling cobra ready to spit poison, all right, to kill the enemies of the sun. And it's sometimes called the uraeus, which is from a Greek word meaning swelling, designating what the cobra does more than any other snake, swelling and spitting poison. So, do we see this in the sky? No. It is so primary to Egyptian mythology that Egyptologists just take it for granted as a symbol, but have long ceased to ask, could this be visible? So that would be one. somewhat more complicated but even more interesting is the so-called Eye of Horus. So we're talking about E-Y-E-I, and we're talking about the god whose hieroglyph is a hawk. Horus is the god of kingship, and the kings have Horus names, and the king is always called a mighty hawk. So the Eye of Horus is on the list of glyphs. It comes after normal eyes. There's an eye, just pure eye. There's an eye with an eyebrow. There's an eye weeping tears in the form of three streaks. Those are all in words about eyes and weeping and so forth. But then there's this strange eye, which in addition to an eye and an eyebrow, has two things underneath it, both coming from the midpoint of the pupil of the eye at the bottom.
Yeah.
One is a curl, which curls out and then curls in on itself in a spiral. The other is something like a staff that goes directly down straight with a little notch. No such eye has ever been seen. Okay? But the Eye of Horus is everywhere in Egyptian mythology, always mysterious to scholars, and it's been worked on particularly lately by Ev Cochran, and some of these ideas I want to make sure are credited to him. He argues that the relation of the god Horus to his eye, which went forth from him and came back to him, is the relation of the planet Mars to the planet Venus under catastrophic circumstances. So the Eye of Horus is a really big one, which I'm going to focus on in my talk most of all.
Now, can you set the stage for us a little bit there of how that would have looked and how you think that they connected that symbol then with the eye? What was the purpose of that? And am I correct in assuming that, all right, it maybe might not have looked exactly what we see when we look at the Eye of Horus, but it's a symbolic representation of it. So there are some elements that are going to be, interpreted on top of it. Or how would you explain that?
Right, you're perfectly right. Even something counterintuitive like this is not an artist's depiction. It remains symbolic and schematic and simplified. I will assure you that if you read Cochran's work, you can find an account in physical terms of every part of that weird Eye of Horus. But let me first set the stage by talking about the phenomenon in Egyptian mythology of eyes that can detach themselves from the brow of a god and go out and come back. Usually when they go out, they rage, is the translation for the term. They create massive destruction. They are objects of terror. And then when they come back to the brow of Horus, there is a pacification. And that can mean everything up to the pacification of the cosmos as a whole. So think of the eye, both of Horus and of the sun, and in other cases, as first, able to detach itself from the brow, and second, destructive, terrifying in its raging when it does. Okay?
Right.
Now, I think I'd like to read you a few sentences from a myth which is very well known, very explicit. It's the legend of the destruction of mankind. And in it, the eye of the sun goes forth in the form of the eye of Hathor, the goddess who is closely related to Horus, because Horus is Hor in hieroglyphics, and Hathor means the house or surrounding of Horus. So this goddess is one of the many famous goddesses of the Near East, Mesopotamia, Inanna and Ishtar, Athena in Greece, and Hathor is one of several names in Egypt. They are all terrifying, destructive goddesses of the sky, brilliant in the sky, and capable of raining down fire and deluge on the earth. So the story is about Ra growing old, tired, feeling inert and weary, and wanting to abdicate. Well, mankind hears about this and says bad things about him, like, wow, he's too old to rule or whatever. I'm now straying from the text, which I'll read to you in a second.
It's okay.
So here's E.A. Wallace Budge's translation. Men and women were speaking words of complaint, saying, "Behold, his majesty, Ra, has grown old." His majesty heard the words of complaint which men and women were uttering, and said unto those who were in his train, "Cry out, and bring to me my eye." And the father gods and the mother gods who were with me even when I was in the primeval watery abyss, let there be brought along with my eye his ministers, and so forth. The eye is brought in the form of Hathor. And when he sets her going, she goes on a rampage which destroys a good deal of mankind. Here is that part of the story. Then the gods spake in the presence of his majesty Ra, saying, "Let thine eye go forth, and let it destroy for thee those who revile thee with words of evil. For there is no eye whatsoever that can go before it and resist thee, and it when it journeyeth in the form of Hathor." Thereupon this goddess went forth and slew the men and women who were on the mountain and desert. Mm. That's the end of what I wanted to read. The humans had become so terrified by what's in the sky that they fled civilization and are on mountaintops, which is in fact a place where this goddess is often worshipped in Greece and Mesopotamia as well as Egypt. So, long story short, she goes on her rampage, and then Ra is afraid she's going to kill all of mankind. And so he does a complicated trick of mixing beer with blood and mandrakes, and she gets drunk on it. And she gets so drunk that she loses interest in destroying mankind. Hmm. It's a lovely story, isn't it? A happy ending, really. So,
yeah, it's interesting. It's it seems then that the within this component of the language itself, and you know what these letters, hieroglyphs later turn out to be, is also then they incorporate an early history of mankind, really, if we can decode it in that way.
Yes, and you know, I read Budge because I have his edition, which has the hieroglyphics on the left and his somewhat archaic English on the right. So I've been going through the hieroglyphics to, you know, make sure that we're on track with those key moments when the hieroglyph is counterintuitive and not what you see around you today.
So answer us again then, because this idea of how you actually began comparing this and how you got the idea that, all right, you know, let's look at the alphabet, you know, you learned the hieroglyphics yourself, and then you, at what point did you start to connect that then with the bigger story that we might be talking about, you know, planetary events, plasma, cosmology, and all that?
Well, just to go back to my youth, my second stroke of luck in working with Velikovsky was in 1973-4, when I, quite independent of his being at Princeton, got a fellowship from Princeton for someone who had already finished his PhD to extend his field of knowledge by looking at other fields. And so I got the Hodder Fellowship, which gave me a year for my project of looking at the earliest inscribed pyramid, the Pyramid of Unis, traditionally dated around 2350 BC. It is not as old as the Great Pyramids, but those pyramids have no inscriptions in them. Unis is the earliest to have inscriptions. And they're all in a burial chamber at the center of the pyramid. You know that the pyramid is the world's stablest structure, because there's nothing for it to fall into.
Yep.
And at the center of it are these chambers where the king's body is embalmed, and then his souls, different words for soul, are made to come alive and to take a new form. So the walls have the hieroglyphs inscribed in stone. They're perfectly preserved. It's so much better than papyrus is to inscribe in stone in a binding, which is essentially the world's most stable book, a pyramid.
Yeah.
So I spent a year doing two things in Princeton. One, studying the Pyramid of Unas to try to see how Velikovsky's theories might be illuminated by them, by it. And secondly, it happened to be the year, the Wunderjahr of Velikovsky, his year of four conferences. And I went with him to all but one. And so he and I had never worked so closely together. Now, I was unable to crack the code of the pyramid text in Velikovskyan terms to my satisfaction. I got lots of little angles and parts and passages, but I have come back to them now that the much more developed polar configuration theory has had its decades to work on. And I found that the work of Talbot and of Ev Cochran throws these things open in more detail than I was able to do back in 73. Just for instance, Ev Cochran has been kind enough to lend me a work in progress on the Egyptian pyramid texts and other texts, trying to crack the mystery of the Eye of Horus or the goddess Hathor. And he identifies her very carefully with much argument with Venus at a time when that planet was like a comet and was raging in the sky, spewing down fire and deluge on the earth. And he works in this essay very carefully within the Egyptian context, but he has a whole book about Venus and Mars called The Martian Metamorphosis. And he will make comparative statements and arguments with Mesopotamia just enough in this argument to make you clear that this is not something just locked up in Egypt.
Right. This is something that's spread to many of the ancient cultures, and we don't want to leave that too much, the Egyptian hieroglyphics, of course, but have you seen this very same story, I guess, kind of coming up in other ancient languages as well?
Absolutely. And Inanna and Ishtar would be the premier case. Athena, as a goddess who also, you might say, went on a rampage to assist Zeus to defeat the Titans, and he was born under circumstances in which Hephaestus took an axe and broke open the brow of Zeus, and out came a fully adult and armed Athena, ready to help her dad defeat the Titans. Okay?
Yeah.
The ancient lyric poet Pindar, who I've studied more than any other Greek poet, says at that she came out with a mighty warrior shout, and the sky trembled then, and so did Mother Earth. Okay? So the birth of Venus, insofar as we can associate, as Velikovsky did, Athena with Venus in her warrior aspect, is attested in a Greek poet. Of course, what Velikovsky did, that Talbot and Cochrane are doing, and others ever since, is really take a global approach. You can go over to Mesoamerica and do this work too. So the fact that F. Cochrane right now is working in a very fine-grained way with a huge body of Egyptian texts is to be put in the context of the fact that he's already done a lot of work globally. And now he's trying to take one of the most resistant and complex and difficult sets of myths and rituals and symbols, the Egyptian, and come forth with a reading of them which really covers all the bases. And this is what I failed to do in my youth in 1973, and I'm very excited that he's doing it so well now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people working on this now and kind of tying this picture together, and it's very interesting to, you know, to see this from the outside, if you will, of all these people, you know, yourself included, really, you know, laying this puzzle, if you will, because it's just extraordinary to think back at those times and see what actually, you know, sparked the imagination so much to create something which is so different, you know, in the sense that, you know, mankind had been chugging along pretty much for millions of years, and then there's certain things that occur which just seems to spark and take, you know, our direction in a completely different way. So when you think about this, and if we think about the language when it began to take shape, more or less, is there any idea to know how long after the actual events that this began to occur? Or are we talking about thousands of years, you know, a few hundred? What do you think?
Well, to answer that question properly, I should mention the name of another major player, Antony Perrat, a professional, much esteemed plasma physicist in Los Alamos. Do you know this name as part of the story of the breakthroughs in plasma physics?
Certainly. We've talked with Dave Talbot many times about Anthony's work. So, yeah, we know about it.
Good. So, Perrat confined his theorizing, for whatever reasons, to a long period which he locates in the Stone Age, in which certain great sky-wide plasma shapes, which he can replicate in his laboratory, because his plasma shapes, they are the same at every scale in the universe, which makes it very convenient for a laboratory scientist. And he argues through use of petroglyphs and other globally present and attested sign systems that mankind was watching in awe the morphing of these plasma shapes over long periods from one to another. I gather he has a total of about 81 plasma shapes, which he's generated in his lab, and which he says the petroglyphs around the world show early man saw in the sky. Now, it's one thing for early man to be in awe of shapes in the sky while the biosphere is unaffected by them. So we can be in awe, but we're not in immediate terror of destruction of our Earth. Perret, who is, you know, working with major players in conventional science and plasma physics, published his article about these Stone Age glyphs, petroglyphs, in the Journal of the IEEE for Electrical Engineers. That's as respectable and peer-reviewed as you can get. But for that very reason, it seems to me, he was not willing to shake things up. I mean, I can't understand his motives, and I won't impute them. He was not at the time ready to shake things up by posing the question, how did that display of his 81 plasma shapes disappear?
Right.
And to disappear, it has to, in a sense, collapse. And would that collapse have been part of events that did affect the biosphere? So he did not become, as we would call him, a catastrophist.
Right.
And I respect his desire to reach people in phases, you know, whatever it is. He did publish these articles in this prestigious journal, and people can take that and make what they will of it. Catastrophists, like Talbot, are then, who had a great breakthrough moment when Perret came to his conference in the year 2000, can then take that and coordinate it with their own reconstruction of a time at which the configurations mankind saw in awe in the sky started changing in ways that affected the Earth and went from awe to terror, all right? I think that's the essential point to get straight when you ask about chronology. That is to say, if you take the conventional framework of a Stone Age followed by a Bronze Age, then I would think it's safest to say that the events that terrorized the biosphere are at the end of the Stone Age and beginning of the Bronze Age. And in Egypt, for instance, the unification of Egypt, of Upper and Lower Egypt, of the whole reach of the Nile from Aswan down, is at the beginning of the Bronze Age, and it involves pharaohs who, on earlier forms than hieroglyphics, on tablets like the Narmer tablet, depict themselves as a hawk. Hmm. And as part of their display of warrior prowess in uniting Egypt. So you have there at the beginning of the Bronze Age and in Egypt of their whole series of pharaohs, someone who was doing on Earth the kind of furious, warlike activity which the planet Mars was seen as doing in the sky. Now here you get to a principle which is fundamental to many interpreters of myth, not just catastrophists, and it's summed up in as above, so below.
Yeah, that's right.
That one? Yeah.
Yeah.
So the idea that humans didn't just cower terrorized by these events, but were crazed in a very specific way to imitate them is, I think, a fundamental idea. The military campaigns of an unprecedented fierceness that unified Egypt under a pharaoh or leader, a military leader who called himself Mars, if Cochrane is right that the hawk is Mars, that Horus is Mars, is something Velikovsky traced too. Not just migrations in time of catastrophe, but wars. Migrations will lead to wars anyway, but wars in which the The leader, who is often usually the king, identifies himself with the planetary body. It's very much the theme of Assyrian mythology and representations too,
right?
For instance. So that's how I would set up a tentative chronology. Now, there are people, Gunnar Heinsohn and Alfred de Grazia, who have shown how traditional chronologies can be compressed. And we usually think, well, they're all fixed by scientific dating methods like radiocarbon and dendrochronology and ice cores. The truth is, as Alfred de Grazia spelled out in his book, Chaos and Creation, that you can take, I think he took 51 forms of dating of man's past and of the planet's past, and showed that only one of them would not be susceptible to being messed up under catastrophic circumstances. That is to say, let's take radiocarbon. If a catastrophic circumstance introduces much more carbon into the atmosphere, that's going to mean that system isn't working. Even things that involve atomic structures, he showed examples can be queered by enough radioactivity, or as we would now say, plasma interchanges.
Right, yeah.
And he says the only system that still works is superposition. If stratum A is underneath stratum B is likely to be later than stratum A. All right.
Right.
And that's what Gunnar Heinsohn has done a lot with. So I'm a great fan of talking about relative chronology rather than absolute chronology.
Well, certainly, you know.
I mean, chronology is a hellishly difficult topic.
Yeah.
And the people who are experts on the traditional chronology tend to think of themselves, or we can think of them as the high priests of ancient history. They possess the ultimate knowledge, they like to think, through which to assign the sequence of events to a specific time frame, whereby you can compare all the cultures on the planet. And if they are challenged, they just grow furious.
Right.
So, you know, good luck to the Gunnar Heinsohns and Alfred de Grazias. I'm not trying to do their work for them. I'm very aware of their work, and I'm sort of rooting for it. But within the world of relative chronology, I think I would risk that the Stone Age, instead of being humans as we know them through so-called Stone Age peoples now, living a normal life in a normal biosphere, it's not by Perrott's reconstruction what was going on at all. People must have been, when they made petroglyphs of those plasma shapes, already engaging in the kind of symbolic representation where you take a shape in the sky and try to make sense of it. If there's any way it can be construed as a human figure, they try to do that.
Right.
And if the human figure has a few extra things that human figures don't have, they'll add them. I don't know if you're acquainted with the squatter man petroglyph.
Oh, yeah, certainly. That's the first thing I was thinking about. This is how they anthropomorphize these particular shapes into... Well, as we always do, right? We project human values on things around us because we identify with that.
Well, you've got it. You understand exactly what I'm talking about. The squatter man is a case of partial anthropomorphization, but counterintuitively, there are these two circles or whatever at his hip, but detached from his body. So once you develop an eye which shows that, which perceives that this is only partially anthropomorphized, and that there are weird counterintuitive things added, then you're ready to go with seeing this as something not just human, not just a symbolic representation of something human, but of something in the sky which the ancients, both Stone Age and Bronze Age, tried their best to relate to themselves by these semi-human shapes, but they knew perfectly well that it was not human. It's a very deep question, isn't it? What early humans would do if they were looking at things in the sky, huge and awesome and changing, even though they weren't yet raining fire and deluge down on the planet, what would the evolution of early man be like? Can we even be sure that we should classify them as human in the same way we classify ourselves? It could be that a certain fundamental property you define as human, namely the capacity to create symbols, was being developed over perhaps a long span of time in the Stone Age, and the human capacity for symbols and for symbolic language was being developed too.
Exactly. Very, very interesting. I think there's something very different between, you know, of the mind of that time and era. And it seems even that the events that we consequently went through with catastrophe and you know, with the, you know, migrations because of this and the whole system being upset, basically, that sets us off, as I said before, in a completely, you know, new direction. And the question is, of course, if we have not only benefited from it in the fact that we've managed to you know, come up with language and all kinds of, you know, interesting things consequently of it, but if we also have been you know, traumatized and hurt by it. That's like the flip side of the argument, I guess, of the problem.
For instance, theorists of language, linguists and otherwise, have noted that under conditions of extreme change, perhaps terrifying change, the evolution of language can be sped up. So given that they come up with this theory just through wars and so on, means that projected further back, we can perhaps say that the idea of language as a slow incremental development, rather like Darwinian species in deep time, may not be the right way to conceive of it. There may have been a proto-language, and then there may have been catastrophes which sped up the development of language.
Yeah.
This is quite hypothetical, but I'm heartened to bring it out because you mentioned regular old human beings chugging along until a catastrophe or some such phrase, you know? And I'm looking back and saying, well, we would recognize these regular old human beings to a certain extent, but not in other ways.
Yeah.
The most extreme advocate of this kind of thinking is Alfred de Grazia in his book, two volumes, Homo Schizo. Have you dealt with de Grazia's work?
No, I haven't actually. You mentioned him a couple of times. It's some one I have to look in more into, of course. Yeah, sounds interesting.
Well, he's, I think, 93 now. And one of the most prolific men I've ever met. You can go to his site, Grazian_archives.com. So his name, Grazia, de Grazia, with an N after it, Grazian_archives. If you Google Grazian Archives, you'll get there. And he has all his books online. I'm very impressed. That's what I'd like to do. If you go there, you can find Homo Schizo, Volume 1. And his notion is that some kind of genetic change induced by changes in the biosphere under catastrophic circumstances might have brought about a rapid change from an earlier form of species to mankind as we know it now. I won't try to summarize his whole argument, but it could not be more different from Darwinian slow incremental change. And do you know the concept of punctuated equilibrium?
No.
Gould and Niles Eldridge have critiqued Darwinism as all slow incremental change by looking at the fossil record and showing that there are periodic, catastrophic, widespread destruction of species given by the fossil record. And then in the ecological niches opened up by those destructions, there are sudden proliferation of new species.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Very rapidly until all the niches are filled again. And then the whole system slows down and proceeds in Darwinian fashion, fine-tuning the evolutionary changes until another catastrophe. Now, Gould and Eldridge were not, they're like crap, they were not ready to go to speculate on the nature of the catastrophic events. But I can tell you this, that in 1980, when Alvarez team, I believe it's father and son, found the smoking gun for the theory that an asteroid ended the barrier between the Cretaceous and the Tertiary, that catastrophism was reborn, and science was now in consensus that it was possible in the past for events of a much mightier scale than anything we see in the present to occur and to be destructive of the biosphere. And I remember that in 1985 or six, Stephen Jay Gould was invited to Bard College, where I've been teaching since 1985, and he was asked to give a commencement address, wisdom for the seniors to take into their future lives. And this is what he talked about. That comet, or asteroid, sorry, that asteroid which hit the Earth and wiped out the dinosaurs and many other species. He said, well, without that asteroid, the ecological niche for our tree-climbing, much smaller primate ancestors would never have been opened. The dinosaurs would have stalked the Earth. We would never have evolved. Man would not exist, man as we know it now, without that asteroid.
Right.
And he said, any cause, any butterfly effect that had shifted the trajectory of that asteroid ever so slightly such that it missed Earth would mean there would be no man now. Okay? What is his wisdom from that for the seniors? He said it means nature doesn't give us meanings. You have to find the meanings yourself.
Yeah.
What kind of meaning is there in the universe where this magnificent species called humankind would not have existed had the trajectory of an asteroid been ever so slightly deflected?
Right. Yeah. Well, it gives us, you know, hints of the magnificence of the timing of everything, and it begs the question, of course, if there's other things guiding the process out there. But you know what I want to do, Bill? Here, I want to take a short break here between our segments. So it's going to take a short pause here and pick this up after the break again. But I do want to just give up some websites before we do that quickly. I'm going to have that link up to the GrazianArchive.com. I found that link right away, so I'll have that up there. And then you have a page on velikovsky.info as well, a little bit of your menu bio on that as well. And then, of course, I want to defer people to relay people to thunderbolts.info. That's, of course, the upcoming talk here on the Electric Universe with a lot of the excellent guests, and we're going to have some of the other gentlemen with us here later on the program as well, Bill. But are there any other websites that you'd like to give out, or where people can find more of your work?
I'm eager to promote a few other people's work myself because I have not yet created my own website. It's important to know that Lowell Thornhill, who is referred to as the most hardcore scientific expert on plasma physics and the plasma cosmology paradigm, has his own website whose name is escaping me, but can be Googled, I think. And it's all his papers. His papers are often in the form of predictions. So he's doing really hardcore science by predicting what a given space probe will find. And then it surprises all the conventional experts, but he's predicted it. So I would like to make a plug for that.
And I know the URL for that, by the way. It's holoscience.com.
There we go. There we go. Thank you. So, he's a model for me. I would like in the short-term future to get all of my essays up the way he has done. But I'm not going to plug any more of my websites at this. Well, let's see. On another occasion when we discuss the Baltic origin of Homer's epic tales, I'll give you a website for that.
Exactly. Yeah, we're going to have that linked up. Well, if you guys are listening to this, in the future, as it were, in the archives, we might have the link up at that stage when Bill's website is up. But we have a couple there then. Check those out. We'll take a short break here, Bill. Stay with us and we'll be right back with more.